So, how did we get on? Did we find any answers to that question or become decisive about it? The question of if we agree that, say, a bicycle or a flower is one, then where is that oneness coming from? Sounds a funny question, but that's the question that this reasoning poses. So, did anybody have any sort of insights into this question while we were doing the discussion? Yes. What's your name, man? Matvey. Matvey. Is the handle that's the religious symbol or the cup itself? So where did the religious symbol bit come in? Bit mysterious. So, what's your reason for saying the oneness comes from the side of the apprehender? Or, yeah, what's your good? What's the reason for that? Yeah, it's the mind that decides what is and what isn't. Okay, so anybody else come to a conclusion they can share with us? Yes, Alison. Yeah, I mean, if it's going to be in this world as a bicycle, it should have two wheels, or it should perform the function of a bicycle. Yeah, well, if we try to be more precise, then a bicycle should have two wheels. So something should perform the function of a bicycle to be a bicycle. Yeah, but once it is able to perform the function of the bicycle, isn't it a bicycle from its own side? Are you answering that question?
its own side, it's a collection. And intermediate bits between atoms and the bicycle, like brains, tires, etc.
Yeah, you sound like a bit like one of these Abhidharmakas, if you don't mind me saying so.
Is that good or bad?
Depends which way you look at it. Do you remember in the sutra quote we had this morning? Somebody says, "Is the bodhisattva a non-production?" Yes, answers yes. And are all the dharmas that the bodhisattva is made of, or whatever it is, that constitute the bodhisattva, are they all a non-production too? So that to me was like a telling answer to these Abhidharmaka types. You know who I mean by the Abhidharmakas? You know, these are the people, again, who are associated with the first wheel of the Dharma, the first wheel of the turning of the Dharma, Four Noble Truths, these individual vehicle practitioners, basing their thoughts on this sort of simpler teaching that Buddha gave as his first teaching. So they've built up their worldview on the basis of that, who haven't penetrated through to the final emptiness of true existence. So that's what they're good at. They're analysing the whole into the parts. They say, oh yeah, well, the whole is only there because the parts are there. So the whole is somehow, you know, just dependent upon the parts, or is like, doesn't have any, you know, own reality. It's, when you say what's really there, well, you're just coming down to the atoms or something like that. Yeah, you keep on taking things apart until you've got these, somehow the atoms are, they have a power to be there in their own right. So they're not just assemblies or collections. They are, you know, the pinpoint things which out of all of which those collections are made. So they have a sort of more solid reality than the things that sort of built up out of them. But it seems like these people who are refuting true existence, you know, that the middle way school is going a bit further than that.
Also, in that school, of course, when you come down to the atom, the whole scheme falls down, because now the modern understanding is that all our laws are left, right, up, down, one space, not one, but two, all fall apart. When you get to the subatomic level, you enter into an entirely different paradigm. A strange paradigm, things exist in multiple places at once, etc. And we can't really follow that reasoning down to a particle and say that particle exists because you won't find it. It just kind of disappears.
Yeah, well, I think in Buddhist school, that's what gave the impetus to the mind-only school. You said, you say that when you analyze things, you want to find reality. Well, everything is built out of these miniature atoms, right? So they're the things that produce everything. We're talking about matter here. If we're talking about consciousness, we're talking about maybe you get down to an individual tiny moment of consciousness out of which all the continuums of consciousness are built up. So they're trying to find some sort of, you know, ultimate reality in which to base everything, whether it's a tiny moment of consciousness, tiny moment of, you know, tiny sort of particle of matter. But then you can come along and have doubts about whether these particles are there. You know, how much reality do they have? So the mind-only people, they're exactly doubting the wisdom of basing your worldview on these tiny particles. They're saying, you know, how can you justify the existence of those? You know, when you look for those, what happens to them? So, you know, don't those tiny particles have parts too? Yeah. So aren't they just like us in the sense that they will also break down into little bits? Where does it end, you know? So there's one view is like trying to get at things in some sort of what you say reductionist way, cutting down to those little particles. And another view we might also bring in here, and again we'll explore it later in, you know, weekends ahead. We don't have to come to some sort of final right view right now. But you know, you've got those other schools in India. You look at what they're saying, and they're trying to say, well, everything is just Brahma, right? Everything is Brahman. They're trying to find reality in unity, you see. So the diversity, oh, you are different from me, I'm different from you, you are you and I am me. That's, you know, the illusion. And the reality is that we're all Brahman. You know, there is this the separation, this is the illusion. And the reality is the oneness. So they're very keen on saying self, you know, with a capital S, so we're all just, Atman is just identified with Brahman, and Atman meaning the self. In its true reality, it's just Brahman. And it's this Maya and it's illusion that we are fragmented into, you know, alienated little bits who are trying to, don't know whether they join up with each other or not. And that's where our suffering comes from. But, you know, we don't realize that we're all just Brahman, you know, I am you, you are me, sort of thing. Oneness. So it's an interesting contrast, oneness, manyness, you know, where's the reality lie?
They don't mean emptiness for Brahman,
do they? No, self. They're not saying a sheer absence. We're trying to make that ultimate truth a sheer absence of something, which was sort of falsely appearing to us. And we realize that that's a false appearance, not a true appearance. So our kind of emptiness is yes, the mind is entering into and engaging with a quite negative phenomena, quite a sort of sheer absence type of phenomena. But they are, I don't like to put words in, you know, just shoot my mouth about things I don't know about. Obviously, there's many varieties of, you know, philosophy from non-Buddhist Indian schools. But that's one way that it is explained, isn't it? That the ultimate reality is this higher self or something, this Brahman is. But it is very, it is, they also insist it's sort of inexpressible. It's not this, it's not that. It's not, you know, you are just something inexpressible type of thing. But the middle way view is trying to get, you know, you've got to see your way through each of those alternatives. I shouldn't think it is, no. But I do, I'm reluctant to talk about things I haven't really studied. But yeah, their view of sort of final reality is somehow emptiness blended with the mind, you know, sort of more, not necessarily just a sheer emptiness, sheer absence. That's possible, yeah. Or, yeah, it's they're sort of a bit beyond my reach, really. But yeah, I definitely accept they have slightly different, subtle kind of things to say, which might be very inspiring. Anybody else have some ideas? Did you explore your idea of the flower? One flower, Anne? But is it one bigger? Delphinium.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Like, we don't say, this is my saddle and frame and tires and wheels and pedals and handlebars. We say, this is my bike. Well, that's very much more convenient to say. But you see how the thing's got a nature of manyness and a nature of oneness. If you think about it, you know, like your flower, composed of many different little flowers, or different parts anyway, like the bicycle's got many parts. So there's something manyness there, isn't there? Some many there, as well as some one. Yeah, but remember our main question is it the oneness? Where's the oneness of the item coming from? Yeah, so the idea about things, it is a bicycle, not from its own side, but because it performs the function of a bicycle or something. Slightly different question. Were you going to say something, Stuart?
No.
I saw your hand waving, but you're just stroking your chin. You've changed your mind now, have you? But remember this, the idea of this reasoning is using the absence of oneness and manyness from the side of the object to prove that the object doesn't exist from the side, from its own side at all. So we're trying to get you to disbelieve in the idea that even the flower is existing from its own side.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like what did you say exactly? Say everything. Yeah. Yeah. I think we should put the mind only view, the pure mind only view, to one side a bit, really, because this is trying to get you to have clear faith, or, you know, confidence in the mother, you know, which is the perfection of wisdom. So here we're looking at this wisdom that we need to travel the Mahayana path. So it's not quite the mind-only view, it's the middle-way view. And out of the middle-way view, it's the autonomy middle-way view, and out of the autonomy sort of varieties, it is the yogic, you know, middle-way autonomy view. So it is, you know, got sort of a synthesis type of thing between mind-only and middle-way view. He's trying to do that, but I think at this stage, it's not so much to do with no external reality. This particular view, that's incorporated, but that's not the essence we're trying to get at, I don't think.
So could we say that the one that's coming from either the side of the apprehended or the apprehended? It comes from either that there's actually no difference between the person, the apprehender.
Mm-hmm. Conventional difference, ultimate no difference. But yeah, you have to bring in the mind-only school if you want to say, you know, there's no external objects. So everything is just an appearance of mind. But that's not quite what this school is saying. Yeah. So I think if you keep it more on the side of the middle way view. But it's obviously we're going to have to talk about it a bit more, and it's difficult to pinpoint. So it's not like we can, just get to it in sort of just this second time round that we think about it. We tried to have a little debate, a little meditation on it the last weekend, but we didn't really succeed. So far, we've got a bit further now, but tomorrow we'll try to meditate on it maybe, probably, you know, try to find time to meditate on it. It's sort of a lot to get through. So definitely we can say that the thing has, when we look at it in one way, we do see many things. Your flower, you see all the petals and the kind of stamens and the leaves and the stalk and so forth, don't you? So you can have, the way it presents itself to your mind, you can, if you take an interest in parts, you can say, well, there's many here, there's many, many parts. So that's perfectly, you know, it seems like a valid cognition, doesn't it? Correct cognition. When you're thinking parts, yes, many parts, there are many parts here. But then when we go to asking about flower, or a bicycle as a whole, then when we're looking at the whole thing, then we can say, yes, there's one thing here. There's a flower, or a large flower, or, you know, a complex flower, or, you know, a sort of a bicycle is there. Yeah, it is one. The bicycle itself is one, and it has many parts. But so we can say that the parts have to be taken into account, you see. So that's what they're asking us to take into account when we sort of, you know, they're inviting us, you know, we should deny true existence. So that means we're refuting that the object is truly existent because it is neither a truly existent one nor a truly existent many. So that's the reasoning. If we, you know, set it out in a very sort of straightforward way, say the flower, it does not truly exist because it's not a truly existent one. It's not a truly existent many. So then, the one we've been concentrating on in the discussion then, it's not a truly existent one, because it has parts. So that's the way their reasoning goes. This is supposed to be the essence of the reasoning. Yeah? It's not a truly existent one, because it has parts. It is one. We're not denying that. You know, if somebody, you show them a flower, say, how many flowers are there? They'll just say, oh, there's one, you know. We're not arguing with that. But what when we're trying to break down our, you know, our sort of our sort of misunderstanding of reality, you know, getting in the way of, you know, the cause of confusion and the cause us to grasp at things in a way they don't exist and, they, you know, cause us, you know, all the problems that arise in samsara, basically coming out of this kind of ignorance. So it's when we think of that oneness as being truly existent, a truly existent oneness. So that's what we have to question. So the flower is not a truly existent one, nor is it a truly existent many. But just following the first line of reasoning first, it's not a truly existent one because it has parts. Okay, it's one. Having parts doesn't stop it being one. You know, if we see all these many things together, the many blotches of colour on the painting, but we can sort of, you know, isolate that and say that's one painting. So when the mental involvement is there, then it seems legitimate to say, yeah, that's my painting. That is a painting. But if you want to say it's a truly existent one, then it has to be one right from within, yeah? One, there has to be one right from the very marrow of his bones, sort of thing. It's got to be one right from the very, you know, essence of the marrow of its bones. So is it like that? But they say, no, it's not like that because it's got parts. So you've got to really get your mind dancing around that one now. You know, I don't think it comes immediately, oh, well, because it's got parts, how can it be truly existent one? But that's what you've got to think about. Is a forest one from the very marrow of its, of the very essence of the marrow of its bones? A forest. Yeah. You've got to collect all those trees together and say, oh, that's a forest now. But everything is, yeah, there's a collection of different parts, physical dimensional parts, that kind of what we called a collection generality. And there's a generality of, like, you know, colour, which pervades red, yellow, blue, green. There's that kind of generality. But you see what you're having to do. You have to pull in your red, yellow, green, blue together and now saying, oh, that's colour, you know. So anything that fits into that category is colour. You know, but the forest is the easy one, maybe, for this time being, yeah. So is that forest, you know, one right from the very essence of its own being? Or is it just you seeing a bunch of, you know, trees and putting a grasping thing on them? Oh, that's a forest. That's, you know, so you making all those trees into one. Yeah. So everything's like that. You see a horse in a field, you've got to have a legs, you know, and a back, tail and neck. Then you can say horse, you know. It's like, you're just, isn't it the unifying act of the mind, yeah? I'd just like to leave you, we'll stop the discussion now, but, you know, we go on tomorrow. This is an idea that friend of mine, Dorje Damdrul, he's a Geshe who's a translator of His Holiness, at least in India. I don't know if he's a translator for His Holiness in England, but he's in Delhi now, in the Tibet House office in Delhi, so he teaches a lot there. So if you're passing through Delhi, it's well worth going to one of his teachings. He loves teaching about Nagarjuna and all this, final view. So he says his idea was you have one of those pictures of a face, say, but it's all made out of pixels, like a modern printing. It's just tiny dots of colour, isn't it? The picture of a face, not a face, but a picture of a face. So if you magnify it, you know, really sort of blow it up, and you could sort of project it onto the whole wall of a room as big as this one, you know, so you'd have a, say, 10 foot high or 12 foot high, you know, 10 feet wide. So then when you stand right up close to it, all you're just going to see is these lots of dots, maybe shades of colour, shades of dots, you know, just, the mind doesn't see anything but just the dots, right? But then when you go to the other side of the room there and look, then what you see, lo and behold, you configure it as a face. So that was his example of how, you know, the object's there, but it's only there through being configured by the mind apprehending it. You see? So is that might be a clear example for you to think about. Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean the cup has parts, even at the molecular level, as molecules as parts. Yeah. So they're a bit hidden from us. So that's another issue. Yeah. Like when we say forest, when we see trees, the trees aren't hidden from us. We make the forest just out of the trees. Seems more like a collection, doesn't it? The forest seems more like a collection of things. The cup is just like, seems to be one solid object, not just a collection. Because the many parts it's made of are hidden, yeah. Although you can still see the gross parts. But that's definitely the area we're working in. So, okay, you've got that face imputed. Configured, I said, didn't it, by the mind, yeah? So that's a good example of how the mind's, you know, playing its role, you know, playing a very crucial role in determining what it's seeing. So is the oneness that we see, is that just the same? You know, it's the mind that's prepared to configure the object as one and give it the name, a single name, like flower or tree or bicycle. So we'll come back to that, you know. We won't exhaust ourselves just trying to get there just in one go. We've got this the paragraphs of on the paper to go through. So perhaps try and have a meditation on that tomorrow. But leave it for now. So I think we should do something on bodhicitta to finish off the day. Although before that, I was thinking we could do some reading through the sutra. That would take us up to, say, 4 o'clock, have a tea break, 4:15. Then we still have 3/4 of an hour to do the meditation. How does that sound, you know? We've got to build up a bit of mental purity. We do some sort of a merit gathering or sort of purifying the negativities by studying, by reading through the text as we've done before. Does that sound all right to you? You can't just keep thinking all day, conceptually, in the proliferations. We have to try and blast the proliferations away by the pure energy of the sutra itself. So each person gets 10 pages again. If you get 10 pages that you read last week, swap it with somebody else and go for it. But first of all, we'll do the quick, you know, refuge and do the opponent powers, yeah? We regret our negative actions and we take refuge, and then we do the remedial, you know, the remedy, which is the virtuous action which counteracts our negativities and the accumulation of negative imprints in our mind, that is to say, and then we resolve not to do those negative actions again. So in this way, having recourse to the four reliances, we have, you know, build up a more pure state of mind. So that it becomes easier to think about the subtleties of the middle way view. So let's just take refuge mentally again. Just we're relying on the Buddhas and the Dharma and the Sangha, with the bodhicitta motivation, of course, with the hope of having an effect on being able to become Buddhas ourselves. So opening up to that, to the pure energy of the Buddhas who can have some great effect on our mind, not just through thinking and understanding their teachings in that kind of, you know, very important way, but just in the very, by their very presence, they can kind of influence us if we are have we got our sort of our minds open to it. Then we regret all our negative actions. So this is our remedial power. We just read out the sutra. Everybody reads aloud, just like last time. Everybody reads aloud all at once. This is a traditional way of doing it. Just read your little bit. Don't worry too much about the meaning. Just try to go, you know, quite briskly. Don't sort of just read slowly. Just try to keep a good pace. And if somebody next to you is reading very slowly, you can help them. It's okay to take one of their pages to help them finish. And then, when you've finished, then you direct the merit you've created towards purifying your mind, making your mind more, you know, sort of useful for the path. Okay, so do you want to give some of these out? So we start from page one, so that's... where's page one gone? It's on this end. How can that be page one? Yes, okay. How did they get mixed up, or have they got mixed up? It's just that one. I borrowed that one, that's right. Okay. So how many are there of us? About 25? Okay. Everybody got one? Yeah. Cute. Okay, so just read away. If while practicing the perfection of wisdom, he goes near any dharma, he is not practicing the perfection of wisdom. If he does not go near, he is not practicing the perfection of wisdom.